Welcome to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT-FM, our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill. It is the 8th of January 2021, the impossibly distant future. So glad that you could tune in for this new episode today when my guest will be, once again, from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine, Dr. Alex Fox Alvarez. I'm so grateful to him for being here. And the topic today is foreign bodies inside our pets. We're going to learn about some of the trouble that our pets can get into and how it might require the urgent attention of a veterinarian. So welcome back to the program, Dr. Fox Alvarez. I'm really glad to have you here.
Yeah, please call me Alex. And it's great to be on there.
Let's just start with a little bit of a story then, because I will try to relate something from my personal life. So I have a kitty.
All right, love
now. I have a kitty now at home, and she had for a little holiday present a bag of kitty toys that she was given. Now, most of these include a larger part of the toy that would not be swallowable. But I've given some thought to like what would happen if she, in her zealous enthusiasm, were to detach some of the components of these toys and swallow them. I might have a situation on my hands.
Oh, yes, you might. And it would be a situation that happens very commonly. So I think that, I mean, I have cats and dogs myself, and I, and with what we pull out of animals, I think that what you've kind of described is probably a very common thing, where the toy, overall, you look at it and you think, oh, they probably couldn't eat that, you know, but maybe there are little dingle dangly bits or strings or feathers or things that that they could tear off or eat, especially if they're going real hard. I mean, sometimes, especially these little kitties will just get on their side and kick as hard as they can at some of these toys. So it's very common for little bits to come off. So the best thing I could say for that is just to keep an eye on it. You know, when you have toys that are starting to get damaged and maybe loved a little bit too much, sometimes it might be better to get them a new one or to replace it if they really love that toy. Some of my pets are very particular.
Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned feathers, because one of the toys that my cat has some feathers on it, and I assume that these trigger some kind of response within her, this kind of predator drive, and she gets very excited, and she does what you're talking about, where she like kind of gets it, and she's kicking, and I'm afraid, you know, that she could swallow it. But here's the thing, is out in nature, I'm sure cats swallow feathers from time to time. But these, they're not even real feathers. I don't know.
Yeah. And you know, feathers probably aren't going to cause a huge problem. I have seen a cat that ate a ton of feathers, down feathers out of it wasn't a toy. It was a type of small little pillow plush thing. But, and that did cause an obstruction, because sometimes you don't think about it, but, you know, small things are mighty in numbers. And so if they maybe ate a lot of something small, they can also kind of find their way into kind of a narrow area of the intestinal tract along the way and start to obstruct and cause a problem there. The other thing we'll see really commonly is, you know, cats aren't as destructive with their toys, but if they have a partner in crime dog, a lot of times they'll get into the cat toys, chew them up there, and that will allow either the cat or the dog kind of to chew something or get into something naughty.
Okay, yeah. So let's not let dogs off the hook here, because we've been talking about cats for the last couple of minutes.
Yeah.
And dogs are famous for their curiosity of human things and the many smells that surround them, and are not unlikely to go through the garbage or go through drawers or eat shoes. I mean, you name it. So dogs also probably are frequently seen by veterinarians with foreign bodies inside them.
Yeah, very, very much so. I mean, when in doubt, a dog gives it a taste. So they get through the garbage, anything at all with any sort of disgusting juice you can imagine on it. Juice from meat, juice from our own bodies, juice, you know, boogers, tissues, or things like that. Dirty diapers, and they'll eat it. And a lot of times they end up here, and we have to go in and remove these things surgically. So they are kind of like the poster children that we think of, I guess, of our four-legged children that come in for foreign bodies. And usually it's younger dogs. Usually the older dogs have kind of calmed down a little bit. Maybe they're sometimes we'll see it, but they're a lot less likely to really kind of destroy things and want to eat them. So it's typically our younger dogs. And what's interesting is, like you mentioned earlier, I mean, in nature, dogs and cats both eat all sorts. You know, they would be, well, dogs are omnivores, so they would be eating all sorts of stuff. And then cats are carnivores, but they would, you know, be eating bones and feathers and things like you said. And I think that that's another reason a lot of folks maybe will kind of play it safe and say, well, it's probably fine. It's just a little bit of bones or this or that. But realistically, you know, those things can cause problems, and they probably do cause problems in wild animals as well, or they've kind of gotten it down. You know, my dog maybe has eaten one bone or two bones in his whole life, rather than, you know, raised by a pack type of wild animal that would have potentially learned what to avoid and what not to avoid from the wisdom of the pack. But we very commonly, those bones, the scary thing about bones is that if they're splintery bones, which is why you may hear chicken wings or rib bones aren't great for dogs, because they can chew them and splinter them up into kind of sharper pieces. And you can imagine that sharp piece sliding through your intestinal tract isn't going to be very uncomfortable. In a best case scenario, it'll kind of scrape through and maybe they have some stomach upset. In a worst case scenario, it can either migrate out of the intestines to kind of poke a hole in it in the abdomen, or just kind of wad up in an area and cause an obstruction where you know, nothing can kind of move through the intestinal tract anymore.
Okay, so I think that what might do us all some good right now is to understand a little bit better the digestive tract and where some of the potential roadblocks or hazards might be within our pets, because some of the things could cause trouble early in the digestive tract and some could cause trouble later on.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And we always think about those as well when they're coming in, kind of based off their clinical signs. As doctors, we're actually able to look at, you know, hear the history and look at your pet and maybe do some x-rays so we can try and determine where what we think likely is going on and how urgent it is. Because if the foreign material can make it pretty far back, once it makes it to colon area, it's good. It's going to make its way through. It made its way all the way through the intestinal tract. But starting kind of from mouth back, things can get lodged in the back of the throat. Not very commonly, but we've seen things like sticks and sharper things, skewers from barbecues that maybe get stabbed up in those areas and cause them to have either hypersalivation, so they're making a lot of saliva or pawing at their mouth. Things typically bones, rawhides, and fish hooks are the three most common things that we'll find in the actual esophagus. So that's the tube that connects mouth to stomach and goes through your chest. And those can be a big challenge because, as you can imagine, you'd have to go into the chest to get to the esophagus to get it out. So it's an open chest surgery for that. But luckily here in many practices, we have what's called flexible endoscopy. So we can go in with a camera actually through the mouth to grab those things out. Although if the foreign body's been sitting there for a while, whatever it is, it might cause damage to the lining or to the esophagus. So in those cases, the sooner the better for us to see them. Next things would go into the stomach, and the stomach's pretty big. It's just a real big expansile pouch of part of the intestinal tube. The intestines from mouth to all the way out the backside, it's really just a long tube that dilates in different areas to allow functions to happen. So the first major dilation is the stomach. And that's where a lot of the digestion will take place. And sometimes dogs will eat things that are caustic, like bleach or any sort of cleaning chemicals that can cause erosions injury in both the esophagus and the stomach. So we always watch and worry for things like that as well. And then some interesting things that we'll find sometime in the stomach are small when they're eaten, but then they expand. So sometimes sponge type things, anything kind of spongy that will swell up with fluid. And one of the most difficult ones we'll see is actually one of those Gorilla Glue, those type expansile foam glues. So they may think, oh, this smells great, and chew up a bottle or something like that. And then they get the chemical in their stomach, and then it starts to expand and actually sticks to the mucosa of the stomach. And they're a challenge to get out of there. But what's really interesting is what you pull out is like a rock solid cast of the stomach. So it looks like, like it made a mold of the stomach. But the stomach narrows, and then it goes from this big old pouch to a much narrower area, and that's where your small intestines start. And so those are pretty similar all the way back until you reach your colon, but they do take a few areas where they have kind of hairpin turns, really tight turns that larger objects can cause a much bigger problem at. So those are locations that we find them very commonly. And what we noticed is that the dogs that have kind of, or cats that have obstructions upper, kind of higher in the intestinal tract, so stomach and early small intestine, they vomit a lot more. They're a lot more dehydrated and a lot more obviously sick, we'll say. You know, they just can't stop vomiting. Versus sometimes the ones that are a little further back, because they're still able to absorb some water and some food, they may just kind of be off or you know, something indicates that something's not right with your pet. I'll say the parents know them best. So if you have a concern, if there's not something not quite right, it's always safer just to bring them in and have us take a look, and we'll listen to you and feel everything and maybe take some x-rays to see what's going on in there. And sometimes our x-rays aren't perfect. So we will sometimes need to do a confirmatory test called an ultrasound, where we go in and look just like they do for pregnant women or for any people. We're able to use an ultrasound and look at the intestines and see what we have going on in there, and if there's any evidence of what we call obstruction or complete obstruction of the intestines.
Okay, fantastic.
Sorry, I know that was a bit of a long streak there.
No, that was a wonderful answer and very informative. And it, of course, raises a lot of questions. With the digestive tract of a dog or a cat, this is maybe trivial information, but about how long in feet or so is this? I mean, it's a pretty long path to go, right?
Yeah, it's going to depend a lot on the patient size, but yeah, it's a pretty long distance. It's, you know, 30 feet, 40 feet, 50 feet between everything, depending on the size of the animal,
yeah.
Really. So once you stretch everything out, there's a lot. So, and that's good and bad, right? So if we're going to, you know, if we start kind of teetering towards treatment here, sometimes the intestine is very badly damaged from these foreign bodies. And unfortunately, we can't just remove the foreign body. We actually have to remove part of the intestines. And luckily, there's so much intestine there that most of the time, with very few exceptions, we're able to remove all of the abnormal tissue and suture the ends back together, and they heal, and the patient still has plenty of intestine left to go on with their normal life. So that redundancy in tissue is actually very, very helpful.
Yeah.
Surgically, for our perspective,
that's,
we appreciate it.
Fantastic. So it doesn't really too much diminish their digestive capacity or whatever it is that they need their intestines for.
No, not unless we take greater than 80% of the bowel, and then we have what's called short bowel syndrome. And it's really just, there's just not enough room and time for the body to do all of its digestive things. And so those dogs will still survive and do well, and they can live comfortable lives, but they typically have chronic diarrhea, and sometimes they'll need vitamins. But the intestinal tract is incredible. As soon as you remove things, or as soon as things change, it starts adapting. And so maybe if you remove the length of it, that's okay. It will start to dilate. So it's bigger, you know, around rather than, because it doesn't have the length. And it's all about trying to increase the area where the inside of the intestines can absorb nutrition through. So luckily they're very, you know, they're very resilient animals, and it's a very resilient organ. So we are able to get in there, but we never really know until we get in there, what we're going to find. And so typically what I'll talk about is from best to worst case scenario. You know, there's just so many things that can go on. It's a long intestines. It could be lots of different foreign bodies. We could find other things in there as well. So typically, I'll say from best to worst case scenario, if we go in there and it was maybe just kind of stuck, and we can manipulate it. You know, sometimes I'll actually inject saline or sterile lubricant mixed with saline in there and kind of mix it around. If it's something, so sometimes you can imagine almost like a bunch of marbles. It's not marbles, but they're all coming together and it's obstructed. But if I could move, you know, a couple of them, just maybe a little bit, then I can relieve the obstruction. So our best case scenario, if we have to go to surgery, is to go in there and be able to milk it to the colon. We don't have to make any incisions. We just have to kind of scoot it along for them and get it through a tough part. And then we're good. The next thing we would potentially have to do is make an incision. So just an incision in the intestine or the stomach or whatever it is, and remove the foreign body. So that's in the case that we get in there and the tissue looks very healthy and happy. It looks very normal. And we can just make an incision, remove it, close that little incision in the intestine, and get out of there. Next is if the intestine is, like I mentioned, starting to kind of devascularize or be very unhealthy or even rupture. So sometimes these big foreign bodies will poke through, or, you know, the intestine's just trying so hard to push it through, it just ruptures the intestine. And in those cases, that's where we would remove any length of abnormal bowel. And thankfully, we can take a little extra just to make sure that we're suturing healthy, happy tissue back together. And that's called a resection and anastomosis, which we shorten to RNA because it's a mouthful. So that's an RNA. And then lastly, there are times where if specific areas of the intestinal tract are damaged, where very important ducts, like from the bile tract or the pancreas, come in, that there's not a whole lot we can do. There are some kind of heroic procedures we can do, but typically dogs don't tolerate them as well as people. And so sometimes, unfortunately, we get in there and the damage is just so bad that that there's nothing we can do for them. And one specific type of foreign body is the ones that do that most frequently. And I would say we call those linear foreign bodies. So those are the ones we'll see more commonly in cats, maybe because they just love strings. And that's what we mean by linear, anything with a string type component to it. So we get all sorts of stuff, right? This time of year, those little silver icicles that you blow onto the Christmas tree, you know?
Yeah, tinsel.
Yeah, there you go. Tinsel, tinsel that you blow on the tree.
Yeah, it's not as popular, thank goodness, as it used to be. It was always such a nightmare and it made a big mess. Yeah, and of course, it's not a digestible thing, right? It's some synthetic material that isn't going to break down in the stomach or anywhere else. And it just serves, once it's in an animal, to as something that can constrict, right?
Yeah, and more so than constricting with the linear components. It's a bit of a visual, but you can imagine it. So these have to get stuck somewhere. So cats can eat strings and things, they can work their way through. The problem is when they get stuck somewhere. So we'll see it with cats with strings. We'll see it with dogs that maybe ate carpet. You know, there can be long threads that come off carpet. So maybe they eat a little bit of carpet and there's a big chunk or a big wad of string, and that gets stuck in the stomach. And then the string keeps going to the intestines for a while, and then maybe it starts to get stuck or hung up because it's attached to the thing that was stuck to the stomach. So the intestine keeps moving in waves back and forth. And it's a very soft tissue. It's very gentle tissue. And it's rubbing on this string that's pulled tight now because it's pulled tight between the stomach where it's stuck and somewhere else at the end of the string. And so it just starts to rub and saw. So it saws through the intestine. And everywhere that the intestine touches, it starts to make little holes in it. And it can really cause a lot of damage. So linear foreign bodies are the ones that are most worried going into that there could be a lot of problems. So I don't mess around. And my dogs eat some strings. I don't usually, or anything linear like that, I usually don't mess around. And in cats, what's really interesting is one thing that they teach us, always do and never forget, if vomiting cat, is to check under their tongue, because sometimes they'll swallow the string and it actually catches on the base of their tongue. And then we've even seen all the way from tongue going out the backside of the anus, a string that once we cut, we were able to kind of, you know, take them to surgery and manipulate it out. But it's kind of a wild thing that you don't think of, you know, something small and wadded up like a string might not cause a problem, but they're actually some of the worst foreign bodies they can get into.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, listen, we need to take a little break right now, but I want to remind listeners that this is Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFTFM. My guest from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine is Dr. Alex Fox Alvarez. We're talking about foreign bodies in our pets, and we're going to be back right after this. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Animal Airwaves Live. I'm Dana Hill. My guest today from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine is Dr. Alex Fox Alvarez, and we're talking today about what happens when our pets ingest foreign bodies, things that are not food, and the myriad troubles that can occur and how they may require veterinary attention. And when we left off, we had been talking quite a bit about the digestive tract itself and some of the things that our pets can get into and how they can cause trouble. And I wonder if we can talk a little bit about some more of these objects. And one of the objects that I was thinking of that could be especially vexing, I would think, and more so because it probably carries with it some temptation at one end, maybe for dogs more than cats. You mentioned fish hooks, but I'm thinking about the fish line that might be attached to it, right? That's a linear foreign body, and it is made out of a synthetic material that's not readily digestible, and it has incredible strength, right? I mean, fishing line is known for its strength, so it seems tailor-made to cause trouble once it's inside an animal.
Oh, yeah. Fishing string can cause a very big problem. And thinking about, you know, the hook itself, too, sometimes you just can't blame the animal when you hear about the story, but some of the stories you hear is it's a baited hook, you know? So maybe there's a hot dog on the end of it or a little fish or something that would be a delicious treat to, you know, a cat or a dog that may be joining their owners on a fishing adventure. So it's not uncommon at all. We'll see that. Well, they'll eat the hook and it'll come with string, or they cut the string. I lived with a very bad Pinterest fail. I don't know if you've heard of people calling Pinterest fails, but when you see a great idea on Pinterest and you think, my roommate, Kat, she's wonderful. When this was back in vet school, and our my other roommate's dog was just this muscly pit bull, really sweet dog, but not the smartest animal. And she saw these great dog feeders, or bird feeders that were hanging. It's a cardboard, you know, trying to recycle a cardboard, paper towel roll covered in peanut butter and seeds that you hang from the tree fishing string. And so this Link, the dog, he went out there and in a very quick order jumped and ate this thing and came inside as happy as can be with, you know, maybe 6 foot of fishing string. So it's coming up from a really high tree. Dangling out of his mouth. And so what do we do? What do you do in that situation? I mean, I was at school at the time in vet school, and they called me to say, oh gosh, what do I do? And you might be tempted to pull it, you know, to pull it, but not knowing what's on the end and how well it's anchored there, it could be a little dangerous pulling it. So what we did, and we ended up rushing him in here to get him looked at. I mean, thankfully it was immediate. We knew he had gotten into it. So it hadn't worked its way down the intestinal tract to cause any problems. But fortunately, we were able to go in there with a camera, because the stomach is the earliest, you know, once it's in your belly, it's the earliest part of the digestive tract, and it's the largest part of the digestive tract. So it's the easiest one for us to get in there with a camera and actually grab out. So that one ended in a happy story. But a hook or anything at the end of fishing string, because they are used in a lot of crafts, can, you know, you kind of have to think about it and make sure that it's out of reach of your pets. But He jumped a pretty good height to get to this, so it was hard to blame them. But it was, thankfully, he's doing great, and so it's kind of funny to look back at. But it's a great point, because fishing string is used for all sorts of things, and it can cause some problems.
Well, if I can share another story, this one goes back to my childhood, please. And it was one of my very few experiences in life having a pet dog. I'm a cat person. Everyone who listens to the show knows that. But when I was a boy, I really wanted a pet dog. And so somehow or other, naturally, this was common longer ago than it, I think it is today in many places, that there would just be like dogs wandering around. I don't know if you remember that, but it used to be that there were just more stray dogs than there are today. Yeah. And I'm grateful that we don't have as bad a problem because of the many wonderful foster groups and the dedicated work of animal services and the shelter, humane societies and so forth. But long ago, it was not uncommon to see stray animals. And so knowing that I desperately wanted a pet dog to be my friend, my family, when I was a boy, brought home this dog. And she looked to be a pointer. She had that look about her, and she did some of the behaviors. And I thought that she was a very gentle and kind companion, and she was those things. But she also was young and in getting into everything. And when I would go to school, I left her in my room. And because I just couldn't foresee the mischief that she would get into, I would come home to find invariably every day something or other destroyed. And often that was just, you know, I learned a lesson. Well, you know, now I don't have headphones anymore or whatever it was that she had consumed, yeah. You know, chewed up and probably not swallowed so much. But one day I had done a very stupid thing. I had had as part of my breakfast, as any unsupervised child would, a big glass of chocolate milk. And so I left the glass in the room, probably up on a dresser or on a shelf somewhere, with a little bit of the chocolate milk at the bottom, you know, the little bit that you can't get out, and it's got some of the chocolate goo from the syrup still in there. And yeah. I came home to find the bottom of the glass, just the heavy base of the glass, geez. And the rest of the glass was just gone. It was inside the dog. I never found it. And so I'm like, ooh, this is... You know, I knew enough even as a boy to know this isn't good. The good news is that she was fine.
And I think, I actually think that's a great story because I'm a surgeon, right? So yeah. I see these cases and when they're ready for surgery. But we see a ton of them. Dogs are amazing. They do eat a lot of stuff. They are omnivorous, you know. So a lot they can get through and a lot they do fine. A lot of the times what they really need is just a little boost of some hydration, maybe a little pain medicine, because what happens is when the obstruction takes place and they can't get ingesta through their intestinal tract anymore and they're vomiting, they get really dehydrated. And your intestinal tract is a very juicy area. I mean, there's a lot of fluids going in and out. And once you start to get dehydrated, it's not as moist in the intestinal tract, not as happy and healthy, blah. And it doesn't move things through as smoothly. And so it's almost like a self-fulfilling cycle where they eat this, it's obstructed, and now they're vomiting, so they're dehydrated, and there's less fluid in the intestinal tract, so it's not going to move through, and they're in pain, and pain can cause what's called ileus, or your intestinal tract to just kind of slow down and stop. It's why some people, you know, after surgeries or things can't use the restroom. We really need to try and nip that in the bud if we can, you know, before they get too dehydrated, or if they are really dehydrated, what they'll do is we'll have them come in here and we'll treat them with gastroprotectants, things that will help settle the stomach, some pain medicine if they need it, and then fluids. We just get them with as much fluids as possible. Very, very high dose of IV fluids so that they get nice and hydrated, starts flushing kind of things through all of the fluids that they lost from vomiting and maybe from diarrhea earlier in this whole episode are restored to them. And then their intestinal tract starts moving and things can move through. So we don't always need to go to surgery. And in fact, probably the majority of the time, we don't need to go to surgery. But it's usually the kind of thing where we do. I find myself often saying, oh, I wish they'd come in sooner just because maybe we could have just treated with fluids, or maybe we could have had a less complicated surgery. So I think when in doubt, it's good to just bring them in and have them looked at. Because if they're good and stable, at least you had that conversation with your veterinarian, they're aware of it. And if something gets worse or anything like that, their whole team is ready, you know, if your pet comes back in. But there are a lot of dogs that they'll just pass through. I mean, I'm sure everybody listening who has a dog has a story where they are walking their dog and saw something very interesting come out of the back end, especially if you have kids, crayons, toys, all sorts of little things. So they can pass things through and even sharp things like glass. And in fact, sometimes if they're not very big, sharp objects, a lot of times what we'll recommend is if you feed them something very bulky, like give them 6 pieces of bread or give them a bunch of rice so that it kind of envelopes it and gives it something, maybe a bit more of a protective coating as it goes through. So your story is great because I think yeah. that's a really interesting
oh
one
my gosh.
Where it's sharp glass and everything and they still manage to get through.
Yeah, I will say about that dog, I had enough dog experience with that one pet that it satisfied for the rest of my life my desire.
Oh, yeah.
I mean she never did me any harm. She was a very loving and excitable animal. We're going to take another break right now. We're going to come back in just a moment with more Animal Airwaves Live. I'm Dana Hill. My guest today from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine is Dr. Alex Fox Alvarez. We're talking about foreign bodies swallowed by our pets. We'll be back right after this. Mm-hmm. Welcome back to Animal Airwaves Live on WUFTFM. I'm Dana Hill. My guest today from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine is Dr. Alex Fox Alvarez. And we're talking about what happens when our pets swallow foreign bodies, things that aren't food, and the kind of mischief it can cause within them. And Dr. Fox Alvarez, I want to, if I can, maybe learn a little bit more about some of the procedures that you have to employ, and in particular, when you do have to do surgery. Now, obviously, we can all surmise that that becomes a bit more expensive than if this can be resolved some other way. So time is of the essence. And when you do have to do surgery, though, there is also the other components that come along with surgery that make it more complicated. And that includes the need for what? General anesthesia. And that includes maybe the, you know, post-surgical care and monitoring. And that includes, you know, the risk that surgery sometimes involves, which might not necessarily be an extreme risk. It might not be, you know, even likely that the animal will not have a successful surgery, but it still is something to consider.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, when we think about outcomes and what we prepare owners for when they come in and we talk about this is just that. I mean, we don't entirely know until we get in there what we're going to find. And I kind of walked you through already the surgeries from no surgery. Well, no intestinal incision. We're able to milk it through the point where we have to resect a large amount of it. And I think that the big things that go into it are we, of course, have to put them under anesthesia and they need to be monitored for that. So we like to watch them before anesthesia just to get them prepped for surgery and as hydrated in their body as primed as possible in their infirmed or sick state to be ready for anesthesia. So there's that component first where we get them as primed as possible and as fast as possible. And then we get them to our anesthesia team and go to surgery. Now, once we get into surgery, what we find is kind of what makes us wonder what sort of post-op care is going to be like. So if we get in there, a very clean abdomen and there's nothing has ruptured or spilled or anything like that, and the tissues look healthy, usually the post-operative care for those patients is pretty straightforward. We watch them for a day or two maybe, and we keep them on fluids and we give them anti-nausea medicine so they feel better. And dogs and cats, they usually bounce back pretty quickly. But if we find a situation when we get in there where the intestine had ruptured and there's fecal material coating all of the organs and bacteria obviously everywhere, then we have, you know, a much more sick patient on our hands and a much less stable patient on our hands. And then those patients are the ones that we may keep for several days in the hospital, and they may need to be kept in the several days in the hospital because there's all these bacterial products that are where they're not supposed to be in the abdomen, and they cause systemic inflammation in the body and just wreak havoc. So what we find in there, it really does set the stage for how they're going to be postoperatively. But thankfully, the majority of cases, they're good. I mean, they come out of surgery and they're feeling really well. And most young dogs are eating right away. So, you know, those ones, I think that we don't have to have as intensive a post-operative care. But the biggest thing to consider, and this is getting a little bit vet med DT for us here, but the intestine takes a while to heal, right? And so what we do know is that the first 3 to 5 days or so, there's no appreciable gain in healing strength of the wound, the surgical wound we created. So if we did a resection and sutured it back together, if we made an incision, for the first 3 to 5 days, everything is reliant on our sutures. And replacing these sutures in, you know, inflamed, unused sometimes, because we can't avoid it. And so that's the time period, the kind of critical window. The first 3 days usually, but 3 to 5, you can stretch it out to and say, just keep a really close eye on them. Because if there's going to be a leak or something, a problem with the actual, you know, surgical site, that's when we'll see it. Because after 3 to 5 days, the body is beyond the phase of healing where it's trying to mostly remove damaged tissue, and it's back at the phase where it's tissue. So our sutures kind of hold everything in place just for the time being while the body is able to get its dust start really rebuilding tissue here. But because of that, those first few days are very vital, and that's why we'll usually keep them at least for the next day. And if you live nearby and it's easy to jump back to the vet, then I think that it's fine for them to go home day two, day three. But if you're a ways away or if your life is busy at home, then I would say for the first 3 days, just let them have some watchful eyes on them. But those are kind of the big postoperative things that we think of.
For animals that have had some tears to their digestive tract as it is, as the foreign body has passed through, I wonder, what are the risks of infection? Because the digestive tract, particularly the intestines, you know, famously not very sterile.
Yeah. Yeah. Covered in bacteria. So usually what we do is in every time we go into the belly, we do what's called an explore. And it's just a stepwise way for us to see all of the organs without getting tunnel vision. You know, it's easy for young veterinarians or surgeons to think maybe when they're going in, oh, well, here's a foreign body, I can see it, and I need, and we're good. And maybe they would miss something, you know, in another area. So to avoid that, we just do a very systematic approach. And so we'll look at all of the organs that aren't intestinal typically first, and then we'll go back to the intestines, and we'll start from the furthest part or that we can see it all the way to the colon, and we'll go through stomach, and we're looking at every surface and feeling it and looking for those areas of damage. Sometimes really small areas of damage, we can just put sutures in and we don't have to actually resect any tissue. But a lot of times, if there's any damage to the GI tract, it's safer just to remove the affected portion and have a nice, clean intestinal kind of closure back to an area without ever having sustained that injury.
And these animals, though, might require some antibiotics or something to stave off the risk of the bacterial infections?
Yeah, if there was a lot of spillage or if there was a lot of contamination, then we typically will put them on antibiotics after. But the dogs and us, I mean, creatures, living things, we do a really good job clearing out bacteria when it's finite. So if you have a hole in your colon that's leaking bacteria nonstop, you know, then we're in a big trouble. But if you, for example, you know, somehow manage to squirt a milliliter of bacteria into a dog's belly, and that's it, they actually will clear that remarkably fast, you know, within hours in a healthy dog. So as long as everything in there is fairly clean and we don't have any source of leakage or contamination, many of these patients don't need long-term antibiotics. We may give them just for a day or two, because we're constantly balancing the risk between using our antibiotics when we need them and then, of course, avoiding resistance. So typically, we'll reserve the use of antibiotics only in cases that had kind of pretty bad contamination preoperatively.
That makes a lot of sense. With the kinds of procedures that you can do that don't involve incisions or surgery, and I'm talking about some of the endoscopy kind of components that you mentioned earlier, is sedation required?
Yeah. So unfortunately, full anesthesia is required for endoscopy. Just because we can't say, you know, we can't really explain it to them and say, all right, you got to sit still. We're going to stick this thing in your mouth or in your nose. And there might be some discomfort. So when you go into the stomach, you know, it's a camera and the camera goes into the stomach and the stomach's not distended with anything. It's just like it's like putting a camera in a pile of bed sheets. They're all wadded up because there's nothing, or I guess a closed down balloon is a much better analogy. So what you have to do is actually inflate air. So they put air in there and they fill up the balloon just a little bit fill up the stomach, sorry, just kind of like a little balloon. And that can be uncomfortable. If you've ever had a full stomach, you know, it's gas pains in there, it's not comfortable. So we can't really explain all of that to a dog. So they're under general anesthesia so they don't feel any pain and that we can navigate and do what we need to do to get our little equipment in there and pull out their foreign body. And once we get in there, depending on the shape of the foreign body, that's kind of where the fun starts, right? So there's larger things and we have these little endoscopic baskets that kind of come out very small and we can expand them, open them up and grab things. It's where you kind of have to get creative because you have these tiny little instruments that you're using and sometimes you have to manipulate quite a large amount of tissue or material in there. And that's a great question. And after surgery, because there were no incisions, those dogs are usually good to go right out the door. We give them some fluids and make sure that they're feeling well. And once they're recovered from their anesthesia, there's no huge risk to them as far as, any secondary complications go.
So with the endoscopy, are you watching the scene unfold on some sort of TV screen?
Yeah. So it's where it's almost like playing like a surgery video game, essentially. You have this little control in your hand and it's attached to the scope and you can't see the scope anymore. So you just have to watch the camera image on a screen. So everybody's looking up, except the anesthesia team. They're focused on the patient, but everyone else is looking up at this big TV screen so that we can navigate and drive through. And they're very fun procedures, I think, because everybody, you know, it's like watching somebody do a very, very elaborate crane game and really nailing it when they get the foreign body. So
yeah,
it's always fun. It's a bit of a celebration when we're able to get whatever it is out of there without having to put the patient through surgery. But it's an interesting, definitely an interesting technique. And I'm glad that we have the technology to do that in our pets.
I'm not going to lie, though. There is a part of it to me that seems like there is a component of suspense and even probably horror sometimes at what's unfolding on the screen. Like I recall a few years ago, I purchased a house that had been empty for a while by the time that I moved in. And when I moved in, I discovered that there were some plumbing problems. And so I called, I called my plumber and I said, well, let's do this thing with the camera. And so they send a camera down into the pipes. And I've got to tell you that it was both suspenseful and horrifying, right? Like, as they go down there. Now, these were pipes that had been largely, like, empty. And rust was the big thing that was, like, the problem, right? But you go through and, like, okay, when are we going to get to the blockage where we find what is, like, holding everything up? And you kind of just sit there, like, with you're kind of got your hands over your eyes and you don't want to look, but you need to look. That is how I think I would feel watching an endoscopy of an animal that had swallowed a foreign body.
Yeah, I think it is. And you probably enjoy it less watching your own pipes, knowing that you're gonna have to, you know, deal with that than if you were just that plumber who gets to cruise around looking through pipes.
Right.
I think it's kind of fun. It's exciting. You know, you're able to go in there and see what you found. And I think, you know, probably the most fun part and the thing that we all, I think enjoy kind of chatting about is like you said, we don't know what we're going to find when we get in there. Dogs eat all sorts of things. And so we pull out all kinds of things, underwears and, pieces of toys and, drapes, carpet, rocks. One time, anything that gets juice on it is not a problem. A lot of times when you're barbecuing, some folks will, you know, you have kind of the drip pan, so you dump it out. But I have seen dogs come in because they ate just dirt and charcoal and stuff that was dumped out because it was still covered in good dripping. So can't really blame them, it's something that I would, you know, I think now, because I've seen all of this, I never would have thought of that. Like, oh, well, the dog's going to eat this, you know, so it's things that I get to warn, you know, friends, family, and all these listeners about, and that kind of stuff that you don't necessarily think of. But be careful where you put your any sort of food drippings like that, because it makes absolutely anything you have there delicious. That's, I think, another reason why we see washcloths and rags and dish towels is because they're often used for cleaning up food, and we'll find them in there. But we found toys are always really fun because it's kids' toys also too. So it's always fun to pull out some army men or like a little round weird knight thing or usually whatever the fad is at the time. I don't know enough about these, but these little things called squinkies were around for a while. There's these tiny little toys, and pretty much any fad tiny toy is going to be in a dog. I'm almost certain that a Tamagotchi must have been pulled out back in the just whatever it is that's that I think kids are playing with is another really common thing. And especially young kids, I mean, they go from, you know, hand full of something sticky and delicious and then touching something else. And so the dogs might kind of find that, smell it, sniff it, and just they can't really help themselves. So,
you hit it at something, right? If we could only allow ourselves to think a little bit more like our pets and look around and see what it is, or sort of smell, so to speak, what it is that they're smelling, and then imagine what it is like to them, that something like a rock might seem entirely unappetizing to you or me, but if it has just, you know, been underneath a barbecue grill and had the grease of 100 hamburgers over the years, like, dripped on it, well, now it probably smells delicious.
Yes, absolutely. It's just seasoning now. Everything's seasoned. Yeah.
Okay, so here at the end of the program, just give us, again, some good advice for everybody listening right now who, you know, some warning signs that maybe are indications that maybe they need to get their animal looked at, and just maybe some good prevention methods.
Yeah. Yeah, I think what you just gave was an excellent advice to start is think like your dog. You know how your dog is, and you know what they get into and what they like. So it is hard because you're not thinking about it all the time. But you know, so think about it before you dump your drippings out or before you throw something away in the garbage in a smaller can, like a bathroom garbage can that they can get to rather than the big one. And then if you know your dog ate something, I think it's good to call your vet and let them know and say they ate this. They know how big your dog is. They've seen, you know, if you have a lab, they've seen 100 labs eat things. So just talk to them about it and let them know, hey, got a piece of this, and they'll get them, you know, your best advice. Nobody has a crystal ball, but a lot of times we'll say, all right, just keep an eye on them, you know, and if they start to vomit, you know, then you should be concerned. And dogs vomit and cats do often. So what I usually will say is if maybe you don't know they got into something, but they vomited. If they keep vomiting, it's usually a sign that something's wrong, whether there's a foreign body or they've gotten into something toxic that makes them feel sick. But if they're throwing up repeatedly, we call it intractable vomiting, where it's just again and again and again, something's wrong and they should come in. So, you know, if when we hear they've been vomiting all day, it should go in. One vomit, and then, I don't know, 3 days later it vomited. It still could be a foreign body, and I think that if it doesn't go away on its own, then it's better to be aggressive. You know, I kind of give them like I don't give them a full three strikes. Depending on how bad it is or what I know, if they definitely ate something, then I'll usually give them two strikes. If they're vomiting a couple times, you know, within an hour, then I think it's safest to bring them in. And if you know they got into something sharp or something long and stringy or something like that, then it's another good time to bring them into the vet and have them taken a look at. Because I can attest, having been in there, a linear foreign body that we just caught versus a linear foreign body that's been there for 4 days is a completely different surgery and completely different, you know, outcome measures of what we're looking at here. So I would say it's okay. You know, I think it's we always – best to err on the side of caution. I mean, it's okay to take a look at it as long as keep an eye on things, as long as you, I think, have a good relationship with a vet in town, and you can touch base with them. But yeah, I mean, those are kind of the two of the big things that I would say. If they're vomiting, listen to your pet. If your pet's not feeling well and it's vomiting and something's off, just go ahead and bring them in. We can do some blood work, we can do some X-rays, and it's not terribly expensive. At least much less expensive than, you know, the whole ordeal if you end up having to go that way. So it's best to kind of go early. So maybe you can get the early efficient treatment that can kind of avoid surgery altogether.
Well, Dr. Alex Fox Alvarez from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine, thank you so much for talking to me today. This was really informative and exciting to learn about, and I appreciate your time. Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah.
I want to say thank you to Sarah Carey over at the UF College of Veterinary Medicine for her help, and thank you for listening. I hope you'll join me again next week for another episode of Animal Airwaves Live. Bye-bye.